Yeah, that is that meta message, and that the Russians have shot Sputnik into orbit, and now we have a space race. We have a similar sort of race that's happening with AI. We see how DeepSeek filters against certain types of topics like Tiananmen Square or who owns the China Sea. Those sort of biases, we want to be able to counter that.
The Adversarial Podcast. Why you gotta be so adversarial? Adversarial. It's time to get adversarial.
Hey guys, welcome back to the Adversarial Podcast. Good to see you, Sunil and Mario. Feels like we got a lot of varied topics to jump into, so we'll jump right into it. First, it sounds like who's going to Black Hat? Sunil, you gonna be there?
Yeah, I do plan on going to Hacker Summer Camp. Vegas over the summer is not my choice of locations, especially having gone through a couple cities in Europe over the past 2 months. Going to 100-degree weather in Vegas with all your sweaty friends isn't what I consider to be a vacation or summer camp.
Yeah. Well, you're going to be there. How can people find you?
I don't know. I'm supposed to be in like 40 places at once. So somehow, hopefully I'll find them. I'll put it that way.
All right. Well, I mean, I assume you're doing all Gnostic-related branded stuff. And so if they are following Gnostic, they'll find you or everything.
Maybe, possibly. Yeah, I think I'm kicking off or keynoting one of the tracks in B-Sides. And then because we won the Black Hat Startup Spotlight last year, I'm supposed to do something there to give away the award. So I'll be somewhere in between those two places.
B-Sides is always cool.
B-Sides is great. Yeah. I mean, that's like, it's much more less commercially than Black Hat. Black Hat's really a commercial affair at this point.
So it sounds like it's not about how to find Sunil. It's like you can't miss him. If you go there, you'll get some Sunil.
Yeah.
Good. Mario, you're staying home?
I'm staying home. And I've never attended Black Hat. So I continue to have that streak in 2025.
I think I've only been once, but I can say that I have been once. I generally prefer, not that it's either or, but I like RSA just because there's so much, someone living on the East Coast, there's always a lot of business to do in the Bay Area, so it's good to knock out a lot of stuff. And there's bikes to ride out there and so on.
And cool people to hang out with.
Great, cool locals to hang out with. That's right, that's right. No, yes, no disparagement right to my Vegas friends, but there's not near as many of you.
Jerry, you could ride bikes in Vegas. You would just die in the process.
I did. Yeah. When I went to Black Hat, I did a group ride with a local out there. And then one other time I did Red Rocks. And It was, the sun is always directly above you wherever you go. There are no shadows in all of the Vegas area between like 8 a.m. and 8 p.m., the entire thing. And we ran out of water and it was just... Oh. We had to get water from tourists at the top of the turnaround, and it was insane. So yeah, done that. Rather do, Mount Tam and Marin anytime. So you'll see me there. All right, let's get into it. It's AI all the time, right? So I know I've been dealing with this a bunch. America's AI Action Plan came out since our last recording, and there's a lot to digest in there. Sunil, you pay close attention to this kind of stuff. You're on the forefront of it. What are the main takeaways you got right away?
So I've actually read through the whole plan. Just because it's one of those, and not just because we're doing stuff in AI, but because this is actually one of those things that I think set the direction for a country in ways that gives us a sense of like what's a high priority for us to be able to win this AI arms race.
And sorry, not to interrupt you here, but when you say you read it, you meant with your eyes and brain.
Not
with a GPT.
I did not send it to an LLM.
We
should just make that distinction. All right. So you read it, like Sunil.
I read it beginning to end and did not send it through an LLM whatsoever.
Okay. Well done.
There are a couple of key points, but one of really the key point is really around we want to win the AI race. And it is arms race. And the main competitor for us is China, of course. There's a lot of things that we feel are necessary to be able to win this race. And there are a lot of pieces that aren't quite in place for us to win. And so the action plan kind of hits upon some of the key things. The biggest one is just reducing the amount of regulations that we have to be able to win. But we'll see this characterized. I've already seen some characterizations of this, the removal of a lot of these regulations, because it ultimately affects things like the environment. It affects things like... all the DEI kind of stuff that we've seen. It affects how we think about what barriers we put towards innovation. The Republicans in general tend to be more forward-leaning in terms of innovation anyway, and driving small business and driving business forward. And so a lot of that is really captured in the AI action plan to reduce the barriers of entry, to spur more innovation, and so on and so forth. There are a couple other major thrusts. One of them is around energy. We need more energy. I think one of the missing elements is that they talk about enabling us to put more power into to create more power for the country. But I think it's also ironic that we're not putting all the options on the table, because we've started to reduce the incentives for renewables, whereas I think we should keep all the options on the table. Like, China is putting out, 250 gigawatts of power just purely through renewables in the first half of this year. And to give some perspective, 250 gigawatts is equivalent to, I think, like 250 nuclear power plants. So they turned on the equivalent of 250 nuclear power plants just purely through solar and renewables. Actually, I think that's just solar. There's others for there's more for renewables as a whole. But anyway, power is a major element to supplying what we need for running these AI models and so on and so forth.
So wait, they took off the gloves for oil and gas and nuclear? Is that correct? Is that what you're saying? But they're not aligning with green energy. Is that right? What you're saying?
Yeah. Whereas I think it should be like, you just put all options on the table.
Yeah.
Get as much power as you can from all sources. Why cripple one segment just because it doesn't appeal to some of your constituents who do like oil, gas, coal, and that kind of stuff?
Too bad. That's too bad.
Well, yeah. You know, let me ask you about I think there's pretty much party lines on green energy versus coal, mm-hmm. but
yeah.
Is nuclear still okay these days, or has it fallen out of favor? Is the administration pro nuclear power?
Well, there was mention of research towards nuclear fusion. Okay. And safer fission as well. I think those are two approaches for creating power that is important for the long term as well. I think that said, there was something missing in that I think that there's a missing element of energy, which is batteries. Storing the power can be sometimes more important than just generating it, because we oftentimes have an excess of power and power needs to go somewhere. And so if we don't have a way to store it temporarily, then we actually can overload the grid, which has happened before.
But what's the meta message, though? It's just removing of barriers, you know, removing government oversight on AI and just, you know, taking the gloves off and let's go after, you know, China? Or what's the meta message here?
Yeah, that is that meta message, and that the Russians have shot Sputnik into orbit, and now we have a space race. We have a similar sort of race that's happening with AI, and it's a race to AGI or whatever enables us to dominate in all aspects of technology, as well as even there was a lot of conversation in the action plan about our perspectives of events. We see how DeepSeek filters against certain types of topics like Tiananmen Square or who owns the China Sea. Those sort of biases, we want to be able to counter that so that the models that the U.S. creates are the models that other people adopt. If we want to, it's a form of influence, if you will, where our values are baked into the models, presumably baked into our models. And so when people use those models, they get those same values.
So the Gulf, it's not the Gulf of Mexico, it's the Gulf of America then, based on our new models. Is that what we're saying?
I sure hope not, but yes.
Yeah, I mean, probably.
No comment.
Yeah. No comment.
Yeah, I mean, like, all these topics are really interesting. Like, it's a question of loyalty. And, you know, you think about, why is our worldview better? Why should it prevail and so on? But I mean, we all do that to some extent. You think about it, you're saying like, well, I don't think the American worldview should be the one that permeates everywhere. And then you turn around and say, buy local. I buy local. I'm a good person. Why? Because my local people are better and I don't want to buy from people abroad because I don't like those people. Whoa, that's not what I meant, but that's kind of what you meant. So, I mean, you know, we all have our favorite sports team, our favorite country, our favorite town. And I think that what the narrative I heard that kind of backed this whole idea was, you know, at first it was AI, scary, could be the end of civilization, hold on. And then it was, hold on, everybody's not playing by those rules. And if we hold on too much, the opposition is not playing by those rules and they're going to run. And so we're going to realize all of the negative outcomes of AI because, and they're going to happen outside of our yard. So it's better to break down the barriers here at home, move faster, innovate, and at least control the messaging, whether it's what everybody likes or not, at least it's our messaging.
It's interesting. I mean, Sunil and maybe Jerry, I'll ask you, not to get too much into politics, but you know, in what I've been reading, at least some of the reports coming out of China, one can appreciate them for being factual, is that there's an employment problem going on in China. Apparently, folks who have gone to school, just like us, are not finding those jobs that they were promised. And I'm wondering if that whole AI is actually, I mean, since China is embracing AI with the gloves off, unless, you know, you talk about Tiananmen Square. But apparently is potentially impacting employment in China. Because that is a concern. Some folks, some politicians, not on the Republican side, but on the Democrat side, are worried that AI is going to cause a lot of job loss.
That is partly self-inflicted, actually. A lot of the job issues or economy issues with China are self-inflicted with a lot of different reasons, whether it's their real estate or their one-child policy from way back when or whatever. There's a lot of things. We can certainly blame AI. In fact, I'm sure at some point they're going to blame AI for it as well. But those are all self-inflicted issues for a number of different reasons. And those issues are being exacerbated because of the tariff wars that were also that we've launched as well. Anyway, but it's one of the other interesting aspects of the Chinese society is you have all these, going back to the one-child policy, you have all these males who were only kids in their family and treated like kings, okay, emperors, if you will. Little emperors. It's a whole society full of people who feel like they have privilege. And so it'll be an interesting social experiment of sorts to see how such a society grows up and how it deals with the rest of the world.
So to recap, I mean, let's talk about AI regulation writ large. For one, in the US, the idea is we want to be efficient and fast and minimize red tape and bureaucracy around AI, and that allowing a balkanization of regulation, e.g. state regs, would be a problem there. And so you see these repeated overtures out of the administration to shut down potential for state-level regulations around AI. And I think that in and of itself, I could get behind individually, meaning you have one rule. Having gone through this on privacy, we definitely have some scars from that. And then the question, the residual question becomes, okay, so if we're going to have one rule, that sounds great. What's the rule set going to be? And we start hearing some hints about that in the action plan. I keep thinking about this, and another side effect of this is export control, right? And then there's a part of this that says, if we are the leaders right now in making, I'll just call them AI processing units, but they're GPUs for now. I think that'll evolve. So if we're the leader in that, then it is an asset, is the rare earth materials of the United States. And we not only want to dominate in that area, but we also want to control the ability for adversarial nations to get GPUs and to use them for war machines, whatever else it may be. And so there's a proposal on the Hill floating around, the Chip Safety Act. And so the general idea is that GPUs should be a controlled substance. There's regulations on where they can be exported to and to whom they can be sold. And then to enforce that, there's this Chip Safety Act flying along that says, all right, let's require the manufacturers, distributors, whoever the supply chain is for GPUs, to make sure they know where they are. And we want to be able to say, hey, if you're not allowed to sell these to North Korea, that's the rule. And now we want to show that you're somehow enforcing that, that you're making sure they're not sold to North Korea. And the Chip Security Act, I might have called it the Chip Safety Act a minute ago. The Chip Security Act, as labeled, it flirts with all these technical ideas, like literally tracking in GPUs and being able to know where they are. And I've got a lot of technologist qualms with that, and I kind of think it's impossible, but I draw parallels to weapons and, you know, and more importantly, ammunition, because there's nowhere near as many machine guns as there are going to be GPUs, and the volume and the pace of manufacture and export has to be a lot higher than that. I think that it doesn't make a ton of sense to try to expect GPUs to have the stack they would need to beacon and all of that, and that it needs to be more administrative, like KYC checks with finance, and the companies have to prove that they're vetting and then experience sampling and audits, and then if there's a thematic issue, have an audit conducted and that sort of thing. Do you feel like there's a technological solution to this problem?
Well, there was a recent article about $1 billion worth of NVIDIA chips being sold on the black market to China shortly before or right around when the tariffs or the ban took place. And so the technical solution or not, technical solution does create other interesting questions around, is there a backdoor and can that backdoor also be used for other nefarious means, right? So if you can beacon, well, what else could you potentially do with that mechanism? So you open up a whole bunch of can of worms here. But I want to think more broadly around, okay, what's the end result of this? Because what we were seeing is really a situation where with the bans, with the undermining of the ability to use these strips, China is maybe, 6 months behind at most? Some people say as close as 2 months behind. So we're talking really, we're not talking about years behind. We're talking a matter of half of a year or maybe, short as 2 months behind of, let's say, the latest progress, wherever that might be. The question for us is that enough to win the race? I mean, yeah, sure. If you're 2 months ahead, then you'll win the race. But what if the race is, there's a lot number of interesting scenarios that happens once you win the race, okay? And most of them are not really good scenarios. They're pretty dystopian in many ways. So what are we racing towards? What's the...
And you mean regardless of who wins?
Yes, exactly.
Just when there's a victor.
Yeah. And if the victor is, who or what maybe is the victor, right? And there's a lot of scenarios that, again, go very go sideways very fast. And there's different views on what people think about whether we'll actually achieve AGI or not. But at this point, we're in a full-out sprint towards that goal.
Yeah. And, you know, when I think about, the rules, if you step back when this all started out, people were saying, should there be industry agreements to pause, right? That was the big talk of last summer, if I remember right. And then should there be a limit of, I forget what measure they were using, say, of computational capability, or should there be gun throttles? And then it all usually came down to, well, let's pause until, and then it was some arbitrary thing that would never really be realized, until a working group was assembled or whatnot. But when I think about the rules of AI, I get really, after a while, I feel like it has to be super simple, almost more about robotics and making it just completely illegal to simulate a human. It has to almost be, again, like what we've done in weapons, where there's different classes of weapons and there's some that are illegal and in theory one can manufacture them. But to date, it's worked pretty well. You don't have a lot of M2 50 caliber machine guns on the streets.
But you're arguing, I guess what you're arguing is then it won't get on the streets, but then there will be states that we may not want them to have that kind of power, right? I mean, Pakistan having, or India having nuclear weapons, North Korea having nuclear weapons. I don't know if we're a safer world for that. Imagine the same thing with some of these AI technologies getting out there. And what I've heard from Sunil is if you try to, even if you have the ability to have a beacon go calls out, it's a pirate victory because, one, you're probably going to find a way to circumvent it. Two, you have a lot of espionage and corporate espionage that people are just, sooner or later, it's going to get in the hands of the wrong people.
Well, yeah. So keep in mind that one other thing that is in the AI action plan is that there's a push to have these models be open source. So we create these open source models and then, of course, China consumes them. So part of that is this notion that, again, whose values are we embedding into these models? We want U.S. values. Okay, so be it. GPT-6 comes out and 2 years or a year from now, and it's open source, let's say. I don't think it will be, but let's say something like that is, or an equivalent to GPT-5 is open source a year from now, and GPT-6 18 months from now. So at some point, the ability to achieve AGI or to get closer towards that becomes democratized to whoever wants it. And I think part of it would seem to me that that's a capability that you'd actually want to keep closer hold, right? Not just give it out to anybody. So that was one of the interesting aspects of the AI action plan that I thought was interesting, that this open source approach may not, it's like saying, here's all the blueprints for how to build a nuclear weapon, right? We tried to keep that close hold for many, many years.
Yeah, I mean, would the benefits of the intended benefits be realized if the models were required to be not necessarily open source, but free? For use and shareable, or I guess those are the same things.
Well, in terms of promoting American values, whatever, however you want to describe that, sure. In terms of containing AI, no, not at all. And I think it's sobering at the end of the AI action plan. So at the very end, it talks about biosecurity and the need for us to have more rigor around the manufacture of bioweapons because these systems will be able to actually help you figure out how to build bioweapons. What I also think was interesting is there's this article called AI 2027. And what I remember about the article was the end scenario. The scenario at the end of it was basically, you know, AI releases this biological weapon, silently affects everyone, and then triggers it with some spray. And then within hours, everyone dies. So,
boy,
yeah, very, you know, not a...
Boy, I know we cybersecurity people have a flair for the dramatic, but I think I picked the wrong week to stuff sniffing glue with this kind of conversations.
Anyway, it goes, again, we're at this point in a prisoner's dilemma where we have no choice but to snitch on the other person. We have no choice but to run as fast as possible towards this goal, and then we'll see how that ends.
That's a good case. Yeah. Well, hey, one other sub-headline on this was something I wouldn't say buried, but something contained in there was something about putting an AI ISAC together, Information Sharing and Analysis Center. And
yeah,
our buddy Errol Weiss replied on that. Did you pick that out of the action plan as well, Sunil?
Yeah, I did notice that. And there were a couple of interesting things about, so first is like, what is an AI incident? And I think what Errol was pointing out is, should this information analysis center, information sharing and analysis center, should it be run by DHS? So in the AI action plan, DHS is the agency that's supposed to run this ISAC, not just the sector lead for it, but to actually run the ISAC itself. That's very different than all the other ISACs that are really run by the private sector. Yeah. In fact, I was wondering, like, who would be invited as members of the AI ISAC? I mean, obviously, the frontier model companies would be ones, but how far down do you want to go? That wasn't clear at all. And how that's going to be run, yeah.
And, you know, when I read it, I mean, as somebody who worked, you know, I was the chair of FSISAC and a board director for 6 years, and so I'm like, really edge case on understanding of it, and the same is true for you, I know, Sunil. It's easy to say, like, whoa, are you nuts? A government-led ISAC, this is a move by the government to get more involved. I don't think that's the case at all. The majority of even the members of the ISACs, no less lay people who learn a little bit about them, assume they were government-run to begin with. It's kind of, I think if you go to the average person and say there's this information sharing analysis center that was initially created by an executive order, and then, you know, in that it said, hey, you guys in the industry get together and create this thing and let us know how it goes. But for most people, and I know just as we were even building membership and especially abroad in FSISAC, it was a constant battle to fight that narrative and explain it's not run by the U.S. government. It's not run by the U.S. government. So I think this move was just someone saying like, oh, yeah, another ISAC. And then the DHS, that'll be the right ones in the government to run it, right? They just assume the government runs it. Could be wrong, but I think Errol's letter is going to be bang on. It's going to be super helpful. And the authors will be more like, oh, yeah, I didn't realize that. Okay, that's cool. No problem. Yeah, we'll fix that. We'll see if we're wrong, but I would think so.
Hopefully they'll correct that, yes. It's sort of like the Federal Reserve Board. People think that's a federal agency when it's really...
Yeah, there you go. All right, good. Well, you know, other topics that we have to jump into here. Enough about AI for just a minute, maybe. Right. And we'll be back. But what I love is to bring back banning ransomware payments. So there was a cool headline, cool for me, headline out of the United Kingdom saying that the UK was going to ban public sector bodies, which is where they have their auspices, and operators of critical national infrastructure, which is really an interesting second cut to that, from paying ransom payments. And in there was also bundled in that even if you're not on that list and therefore banned from it, that we're going to require notification to the government if you're in this situation. No secret on this podcast that I thought this is a good idea, the banning at least. Do you guys still feel like it's a slippery slope or fraught with danger? Or are you happy to see our friends across the pond doing a great experiment before we have to get married to it ourselves?
Always happy to learn from other people's mistakes.
Mistakes?
Well, no, I mean, I'm not saying that the banning is a mistake, but I think along the way, we'll learn things that I've mentioned. I think enterprises will still need some other mechanism to, it's actually sort of like what Coinbase did, right? It's like, you know what? I'm not going to pay your ransom, but I'm going to put a bounty on you for the same amount, right? It's like, yeah, I like that.
I know, Jerry, you've been spousing this argument with us for at least more than a year, and I'm sure even before then. So now we can say, well, first of all, I want to see when it actually happens, because at that point, I'm just going to say pigs have grown wings, right? I'm still going to be Cruncherian here, Jerry. I don't think it's going to happen. I think people are going to push back. People just, they don't have the infrastructure, right? They don't have the systems right now to recover.
Yeah, I mean, I think, look, if just one country does it, if just the UK does this, that's not going to be enough to shut down the machine, right? You're just going to have ransomware operators out there. And so now they're just counting on them getting the memo, right? It's almost like we really hope they know that UK entities are banned from ransom, because otherwise, if they are just spraying and praying and they hit UK entities every X times, they're still not disincentivized from operating at all. They're not going to shut down. They're still going to exist, be trying to target US companies and others. And if they just sweep up some UK ones, then we have the worst of both worlds, right? Because they're getting hit still and they're not allowed to pay. And what we really want is that the incentive is gone and the operator is completely shut down and then they're not even there to begin with. So if this goes into effect, it's going to be kind of almost comical, but the UK is going to have to put out some kind of PR campaign geared towards ransomware operators to make sure they all know that the UK can't pay, because otherwise they're just going to sweep them up by accident. And I'd hate to see it disprove my point simply because it's such a small universe of potential victims, you know, whereas I think that the majority of victims being US-based, that's where it would have the most impact.
There was this ransomware that impacted, I don't know if you guys saw this, but maybe it was a month ago or 6 weeks ago. And it was around some place, I forget where it was in the United States, that supplies a lot of groceries for grocery places, you know, so milk, or I don't know if it was eggs, but it was big enough that my wife would go to her favorite market. She goes there and she goes one day and she's like, comes back, says that entire, you know, aisle is gone. They just don't have anything. And apparently it's because they're not an aisle, but it was a refrigerator side. She had thought, she had heard that it was because the refrigerator went bad locally there. And as it turns out, 2-3 days later, it was the entire bunch of supermarkets were impacted. And it was because some ransomware or group was successfully attacked one of these suppliers, big suppliers. And again, I don't know where in the United States. I guess where am I leading this with this? I don't know if that company paid the ransomware to come back, but it took 5-6 weeks to come back. I think if, Jerry, if you're right, I think if this were to work, it'd be great, in my opinion. You're right, but it's going to be painful. We're going to go through a painful experience. And if we don't all do it globally, there's always going to be some country that's going to pay.
Yeah, you're right. Well, kudos to the UK for considering. I hope that they go forward with it, but other people have to follow really quick, or we're going to have this really awkward adolescent phase. And yeah, United Natural Foods, I saw that. And in particular, there was a distributor to many, among many others, Whole Foods. And that's where a lot of people noticed it.
And I actually overheard a conversation, me listening, tapping into people's conversations on the streets, right?
That's what we do in cyber. Yeah.
Right. And it was these two restaurateurs who were basically couldn't, you know, complete their menu because they were missing a lot of that stuff.
Yeah, it hits close to home. All right, another interesting headline here. So a lot of people have been scrambling over the last 3 weeks or so to respond to some SharePoint vulnerabilities that came out. The good news, you can kind of smell these after decades working in this. I mean, you can immediately say like, oh, this is a panic. I bet. I mean, this one, I was like, I bet this is just if you are operating raw SharePoint and relying on the built-in authentication screens and just putting it on the internet and not putting it behind a VPN or private network or hosting it in the Microsoft IDP secured Azure instances and so on. And that was the case here. So it was people who were operating their own on-prem SharePoint and so on. But in any event, the sub headline that I think is really worth discussing now is how the bad guys may have found out about that. And Mario, what did you hear about this? And what does it make you worry about?
If this is in fact Chinese hackers, and if, you know, Sunil's, you know, clarified some stuff for us in last episode that not North Korean attackers are in North Korea, they're outside of North Korea. Maybe these Chinese hackers are not really working in China. But regardless, let's say they were working in China. Nothing in China happens without the Chinese government approving it when it comes to this sort of attacks. It's not like Russia. It's not like other countries. China has a really tight control on this. And we were trying, when I was at a previous company, we were trying to gain entry into the Chinese commerce there. We weren't selling to the Chinese government per se. We were just selling to international companies doing business in China. So not selling to the government, selling to international companies to support them while they do business in China. Well, one of the rules or laws that the Chinese government was imposing on us, this was 2 years ago, was that even though we weren't doing business with them, the Chinese government, we needed to provide them with, you know, if we found a vulnerability or a zero-day vulnerability, that we needed to notify the government of China about that event or about that vulnerability, even though it didn't impact them necessarily. So I'm wondering if this is now we're getting to see some of the results of that.
Yeah. Yeah, right. I had heard a discussion of that as well, where there's a compunction to share this vulnerability data. And so if you're a researcher, you're subject to that. I mean, a bounty hunter for that matter, that you find a zero day that you're supposed to also share that through government channels. And then this is kind of interesting, though, if you are just on the, I remember Mandiant would brief critical infrastructure entities, right? We had a little club of critical infrastructure, and they were and they'd engage and give us some heads up. And I remember it was always like, we're letting you know first, we're not planning on a wider distribution for about a week, but this might get leaked and then you'll see us go live tomorrow morning or whatever it is. They always gave us that warning, and some of this actually happened. But if you're a recipient of advanced notification through Microsoft and then you're under those laws in China, does that mean you immediately have to say, yeah, I'm sorry, I know that the slide B says it's confidential, us only, TLP red, but law trumps that. I've got to let the government know. There's some curiosities here of whether Microsoft letting their advanced notification program know is what leaked it, because I guess the initial compromise and exploit of this followed right after that advanced notification, yeah?
Well, the question of how quickly can you weaponize something after announcing it, that there's still, you know, it's not sometimes that trivial to turn a discovered vulnerability into a weaponized sort of exploit. But that said, I think the general perspective I would have here is that Microsoft and other vendors have this trusted group, supposedly trusted group, that they share and they provide advanced warning to. And I remember being part of some of these groups when we were at Bank of America, where we would get early notification. And if we violated if something was shared, and it's kind of hard to sometimes pin who shared it, but if you shared it outside of the non-disclosure agreements that we established then, that's a pretty serious breach of these terms. Of course, you can get kicked out of the program, but they may also have other financial means to, say, come after you as well. But anyway, at the end of the day, it seems like it was a breach of some non-disclosure, some arrangement that happened through MAP. It could be, right? I think the original disclosures came as a part of the original vulnerabilities were discovered through the zero-day initiative that Trend Micro has as well. So there's a couple of different possible avenues that we can potentially point to where this could have been leaked.
You know, there are two things, a couple of things. And just want to be crystal clear, you know, the company I was at, had nothing to do with this. So you share points. So just to clarify, anybody listening, it wasn't me. It wasn't us. Okay.
Well, yeah. Well, I think there are a couple of things to learn from here. One is, why are you still running on-premise SharePoint? Why do you still have your own SharePoint server? It's sort of like asking, why are you still running Exchange? For the most part, those who were running in the Microsoft-hosted environments that didn't have this issue. It's only those who had were running on-prem or their own environments. So that's one. Two, I think in the context of, there's a broader set of concerns that I think we have around just the use of Microsoft products. And there was a whole recent article, it was in ProPublica, around Microsoft using digital escorts to manage our government computing environments. So basically, you have Azure, but then you have a government version of Azure, and those are meant for higher security, more sensitive things. And Microsoft was using digital escorts from other parts of the world, like China, to help troubleshoot issues that were in these high security environments. I'm like, come on, Microsoft. Like, it's not just about patch things, fix things, but invite people from hostile countries right into our government security systems. I mean, come on. That's a bit ridiculous.
Yeah. Well, I'll go back to where you started on this whole thing, and you're talking about if you have SharePoint, then, you know, hey, what did you expect, right? But I mean, I think for our audience and you know, a lot of security leaders and risk managers. I think the glaring takeaway from that is that you're never going to succeed playing whack-a-mole and chasing all these patches and all of that. You know, and that's why I always say patching is overrated. What I mean by that is if you have to rely on reading the news wires all day and the minute something comes out, you know, running and panicking and getting the patch and installing it, you're going to lose every time. To me, the most critical risk that comes out isn't a CVE, meaning you have a patch needed because there's a vulnerability. It's more attack service. It's more you have an exposed network daemon. So for example, a lot of our audience love SSH and command line and running things. And when you go to a medium-sized org that isn't quite enterprise yet, you inevitably find that the SREs will want to be able to SSH into things and work on them remotely. And so they'll open up that SSH to the internet. And they feel like, well, secure-wise, it's good because A, it's SSH and it's encrypted. And B, I'm using public key authentication, so it's not just a password. And then C will be, and I've patched the SSH daemon to the latest version, so there's no security vulnerabilities. And I have this little like adage I say that with enough time, all daemons will have a zero-day exploit. Yeah. Like it's just a matter of time. And so if you tell me it's good today, it won't be tomorrow. So if you have SharePoint on-prem and just put it behind a VPN, you know, I mean, you consolidate your attack surface to one thing that you're going to stay up reading the tweets about, which is your VPN, and then that's it. And by the way, just to be 100% clear, I'm not talking about NordVPN and Tor and all this hide your packets through other countries.
You're talking about Jerry.
I'm talking about Cisco AnyConnect, some fat, nasty, or please use Cloudflare Warp or Tailscale or whatever, but like something where you couldn't get there without this thing and you're trying to get to your internal resources and then run three patch levels behind, whatever. When you cut down the attack surface, you win. But if you have something that's open to the outside world, it's only a matter of time. And if you were subject to this and you patched, you're not done at all. Get it off the internet and go back to bed. That's what you need to do.
I mean, there are two additional things all of you guys are saying, but highlighting your points, but remembering when we were going through this whole move of doing business in China, somebody keep me honest, sometime around 2-3 years ago, if you went to China and you were going to use Azure, I don't think you could use the SaaS version of SaaS, of SharePoint. You had to use the on-prem version of SharePoint in China. Somebody keep me honest, because I do believe that was the case. So that again blends into, that's why, you know, you have SharePoint running there locally. You give your code to the Chinese government. You can see where this can lead to, potentially. That's why, yes, Neil? But somebody keep me honest, because I'm not sure
of the specifics, but if I were to guess, it would have been you couldn't run it because Microsoft maybe couldn't host it in China, whereas China wanted you to have it entirely hosted in China.
Data domiciling.
That'd be my guess. Yeah, the domiciling requirements. And Microsoft wasn't prepared or didn't have the mechanism to run it in country.
And my final point to this, I did talk to the folks in Azure and AWS, and I would always question, I mean, you know, why are you doing business in China knowing the practices that they do where you have to give them your code? And their argument was, that's fine. We're going to be 6-8 months ahead of them because the version we have in America or online, the SaaS version of it, is just a newer version.
I can't help but think of this. Like one recurring theme I've seen when it comes to especially the deltas with law and custom in China is U.S. companies trying to flirt or skirt the regulations and the laws, right? I mean, as security practitioners, how many times have you heard your peers, because I know you guys would never do this, how many times have you had your peers ask about, hey, what VPN do you find is working to tunnel traffic out of China to avoid the Great Firewall of China? And it's gotten down. Maybe it's different now, but at the heyday, it wasn't like, hey, we want to get around the government. It was almost like, hey, it's kind of slow. And we know that didn't mean for things to be slow. And we're just trying to make things faster so we could do business in China. And I think as security practitioners, we always talk about enabling the business and ways that we could add value and ways we could stay out of the way. But I think we need to be really red line about breaking the law and not just the headquarters law. If you're operating in China, security should not be suggesting, enabling any way to break the law. The business should feel the full brunt and pain. And if that means that it's a awful experience to use the internet, then let it be an awful experience to use the internet, or that's never going to change. If, you know, a few ivory tower U.S. companies have a great experience because they tunnel over private lines out of China and everyone just puts their head in the sand and it's technically illegal, but it's okay. Totally. You're not doing your company a favor and you're not doing any favors for the macro environment for fixing that.
Totally. In fact, China, there are ways of not bypassing it, but getting going through the approved methods that are way faster, better connections. But the Chinese government will tell you if you have more than this much of data that you're transferring and very small amount of data, they want to see the data. They want to have access to that data you're moving. So you can go fast, folks, go fast. And we're going to give you the ability to go fast, but we need to have access to your data. And that was very made clear to us very on day one.
Yeah, and I think as a security leader, the right move there isn't to compete with China on tech foo and try to tunnel stuff and get around it. It needs to be to comply and say, hey, we're going faster. It's this entire government agency can see all of our data and throw it in the risk register, raise it to the flagpole. And, you know, people try to talk about risk acceptance. That's a great potential candidate for risk acceptance. Is the business okay with him, everybody being able to read that or not? But don't enable them. I mean, it's, you don't want to be the fall guy, right? And then, because you're going to end up being the scapegoat later on. If there is some kind of action over there, it's going to be, well, we had to comply, you know, Acme Corp is committed to following all laws and regulations, and it's just that cowboy who went and skirted that, and we've taken care of that problem.
And you know, Jerry, that's a very important point. I mean, that is where we as leaders, security leaders, need to show our mettle. We were able to demonstrate that to our business. For all intents and purposes, we have two separate environments, one that was running in China and one was completely separate in the rest of the world because of these things, right? So that was really important. And so the business understands, I mean, I think most business people understand and appreciate that you don't want your customers' data to be being sniffed by a third party.
But how many security leaders are out there dropping VMs in cloud environments for the Beijing office to use so that they don't have to deal with this, that, and the other? That's illegal. Just don't even do it. Make it more painful. All right. On a hopefully lighter note, Mario brought up, and we're both in, I'm assuming in the Slack too, where someone was asking, and someone kind of new to the CISO role was saying, hey, I'm getting nonstop offers for free this, that, or the other if I take the sales call. How do people deal with that? What are some of the ethical considerations around that? Look, with full awareness that it's easier once you're done being a CISO to throw stones. Do you have reactions to all of this, you know, $200 gift card, bottle of wine and a trip to the vineyard too, if you hear out these vendors? What are your reactions to that stuff?
Well, don't do it. I think it's the easiest thing. You don't need a gift. There's no reason for a gift for a vendor. Look, vendor, I think we all work for vendors. I mean, we're all part of, two of you are working at a security startups and I worked at a security startup. And you're always looking for ways to have a meeting with someone. And so I don't think there's any negative. I can speak for both of you as well. And I'll speak for the company I was at Ambit. There was no negative anything, no negative intention, no way of trying to manipulate people here by giving them gifts. We just wanted to have an excuse to have a conversation with you. And that may not be maybe acceptable in most places. As a consumer, I would just say, I don't need a gift from you. Let me go talk with you. Let me find out about your technology because I'm generally interested in learning about the technology. And I think that just makes things a lot easier. Now, I'll just add one more before I get out of my soapbox. I had a CEO from a security company call me last week and they had asked me to help them. They apparently have been getting trash in a lot of CISO circles and they were asking for help to say, hey, why are we getting trash? Or can you talk to people and see if we can have a conversation with them? And one of the things the CEO suggested was, hey, and I'll give you some shares for this. And I'm like, I don't want that.
I love it.
I'm like, that just ruins it. It just ruins it.
Yeah.
I have no need for RSUs or shares or anything like that because it just taints me. It taints the whole reason for us wanting to have a conversation with you. And so I kind of said to the guy, it's just not going to work for me.
Yeah. I mean, what you mentioned early on, I'm going to pick at it here. You might, You'll be thinking about this all night. I know how you are, Mario. What you said was, as security vendor, I'm not talking about you personally, but security vendors aren't trying to do anything untoward. They're just trying to get a conversation. The fear is that they will bias the potential buyer into making into favoring them for because of the personal gain, because of the Amazon card, instead of just representing the organization's best interests. Is this the best SEM? Is this the best EDR? Oh, well, and they also brought me to the vineyard, whatever it's going to be. As a company to say, like, we're not trying to do anything abusive here. We're just trying to get a conversation. Those are in conflict. You know, having that conversation is to sell the product 100%, right? There's a fiduciary duty, you know, if you're at the vendor to close business at all costs. And so, I mean, I think even just wanting to have a conversation, as polite as it sounds, it does trip the concern from the buyer standpoint, because you are trying, you absolutely want to make that person favor you, whether it's not even look at the competitors, don't even know what they're doing. Right?
I also, as a customer on the other side, don't accept the gifts regardless, right? Yeah.
I would say, so when I was a CISO, I'm sure in the early days, there's a lot of gray area too, right? Like, my team would go to baseball games with the VAR and that kind of thing. And I'm like, I want to tell them not to.
CISO dinners.
Yeah. But you know what? I made more money than them and I can afford nicer dinners. And, you know, if they couldn't, what kind of jerk am I, you know, taking food off their table and being like, no, don't do that. One thing that I did do that I think was a really cool trick as a CISO, it's a trick, right? Because at the end of the day, you can afford your own dinner or your own Amazon card or whatever. But every time that I would get an unsolicited gift, and, you know, it would happen with some regularity. I mean, literally bottles of wine, we got a cake once, all kinds of stuff, you know, grill accessories, Yeti mugs, all that kind of stuff. I would literally scrape the vendor logo off of it.
Oh.
And then put it in a shared area and give it to the whole security team. So there was this room that we had that always would just have free gifts or whatever it was going to be, as long as there was no attribution, because I didn't want to perpetuate the bribe. So it was just like things that had the logos scraped off of them and not take it myself. Because then I was being, because I was the one who knew who it was. And I felt like if you knew who it was, then you shouldn't be able to take it.
I could not give those Yeti bottles away I practically begged people when I was a vendor, you know, I'm just take them. These are really nice Yeti things. It turns out that we came out with bouncy balls that once you bounce them, they lit up. That's what everybody wanted. They didn't want the Yeti bottles. They said, I have hundreds of those at home. I can't use them anymore.
Well, I mean, to the advice for a new CISO, you know, ideally you just say no to all of that. Where's the gray line? I mean, at a minimum, you want to check with your company policy and go along those lines. I hate to just be a generic cardboard cutout lawyer, but I can't fault anyone for taking some of this stuff because, like I said, you know, not everybody has made it as far, and it's worth more to different people than others.
Yeah, it's. So most company policies may have the threshold too low. I think I remember at Bank of America, something like $50 was the threshold. But, you know, there's easily a steak dinner would go past that threshold. But that said, I think there's another principle at play here that is worth considering. One of my favorite authors, Adam Grant, he wrote this book, Give and Take, and compared the difference between the two different styles. So givers are characterized by their tendency to help others and not necessarily expect anything in return, while takers basically prioritize themselves and their own gain and are more focused on just what we can, you know, what we can get from others. And I think I'm going to conjecture something here, that those in the security profession are generally characterized by their tendency to help others, right? That's kind of why we're in security, because we're trying to help others. And so I think most of us are naturally in that giver mode, which kind of makes me I'm just throwing it out there, and this is definitely a generalization, but if you find yourself to be a taker, I wonder if security is the right place for you, because I think the mindset for us in security is that we are givers, right? I think that's maybe why this is even a challenge. I think perhaps in any other profession, C-suite profession, they're like, that's not an issue. I'll take it all I want, because maybe that's their mindset. So anyway, just throwing it out there.
That's interesting. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. Maybe I'm more pessimistic. I don't feel like we're, as security people, more altruistic. I feel like it's the same split, right? We're talking about transactional people. Whether or not you're transactional, I feel like there's just as many in security, but I don't know. A funny anecdote, though, you'll like this, I think. You'll also, the similar topic is like compliance policies around conflicts of interest and whether or not you can be compensated by a vendor. And right, these are all important topics that come up. And one time I was talking to a security exec at a company about investing in a fund. And, you know, it was the usual, like, check your personal trading policies and see. And some companies are totally fine with that. And others you have to just get approval for it. And others is totally banned. And so he goes through it. And in his case, he had to get it vetted with the CFO. And he asked the CFO, hey, I want to do this thing. I think it's okay, but, you know, I'm supposed to check. What do you think of it? And the CFO's response was, he looked at it and he goes, wow, that looks like a pretty cool opportunity. You know, you're in a good spot here. You have deal flow that you're able to get access to a cool investment opportunity like this. I'll approve it, but you got to get me in too.
Oh.
I kid you not.
Oh.
That's what the CFO actually said. I was like, hey, he told me, he wasn't like, hey, can you get him in with me too? He wasn't sure about what to do next. And I was like, let's just pass on this. What a red flag.
I will say this about the CFO at Snowflake, Mike Scarpelli. When he first joined Snowflake and I had my meeting with him, and he told me he had CISOs reporting him before, and he fired two of them. And I asked, why did you fire them? And one of them, he said, he was basically investing in these companies, startups, but then also promoting them in the company and actually approving, you know, purchases of buying their product. And when he found out, our CFO, Mike, is an outstanding CFO. And I think a lot of people in that position understand what problems that brings.
Yeah, good on him. Yeah.
Yeah, good for him.
Yeah, it's that CyberStarts thing we talked about last year over again. And
Yeah.
I mean, hey, there's a little proof that I was saying that we're not all.
Hey, that was only a handful, Jerry. I'm with Sunil. Yeah.
Okay. Anyway. On that note, let's wrap up. Great to see you guys. Great to talk to you as always. And I'm looking forward to the next episode already.